Strangers, if you love grilling, you know that your equipment is only going to take you so far. If the quality of the meat you're throwing on your fancy grill is subpar, you're gonna get subpar grilled meat. And whether you're grilling out for a regular weekday meal or you're hosting a big summer party, ButcherBox has the highest quality proteins for all your carnivorous guests, and even the pescatarians. Listen, their raw meats are great, but I'm not gonna lie, sometimes I want a chicken nugget. And you know I'm not about to go out and get fast food. I love ButcherBox's organic, free-range chicken nuggets. For real, they're delicious. ButcherBox delivers over 100 premium protein options straight to your door, from grass-fed beef to wild-caught salmon. It's all raised and sourced the right way. No antibiotics, no added hormones, no fillers. Just clean, reliable protein you can feel good serving. Plus, it's super flexible. You can customize your box based on what you're cooking, and it all ships free with recipes, grilling tips, and exclusive deals. So whether you're a beginner or a grill master, you've got everything you need to make it a great season. As an exclusive offer, new listeners can get their choice between free ribeyes for a year or ground beef or chicken breast for life. Plus, $20 off when you go to butcherbox.com/unexplained. That's right, your choice of ribeyes for a year or ground beef or chicken breast for life. Plus, $20 off your first box and free shipping always. That's butcherbox.com/unexplained. Don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you. How far would you go to expose the truth? If you knew in your heart that those at the very tops of power were involved in a conspiracy involving the assassination of our president, how much would you risk to expose them? How many warnings would it take before you backed off? Would you put your very life on the line to expose the truth? Welcome to Strange and Unexplained with me, Daisy Egan. Sometimes I think about how some of the biggest names of yesteryear are all but forgotten today. It's wild how someone could have meant so much to people in their day and then fade into obscurity as the decades pass. I heard an anecdote that some young gays don't know who Judy Garland was. I hope that one isn't real, because shame. But even the brightest stars fade eventually. Someday there may be young gays who go, "Who was Beyoncé?" Or worse, who was Daisy Egan? Could you imagine? The horror. Dorothy Kilgallen was a household name in her day, and I'd venture a bold guess that only a handful of you have heard of her. And if you have, you're probably a journalist of some kind. Dorothy was a staple of the New York City social set, a fixture on television, radio, and print. The men in charge said, "Girls can't do that," and Dorothy said, "Watch me." In his book, The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, author Mark Shaw likened Dorothy to Oprah Winfrey, Barbara Walters, and Diane Sawyer in her reach and accomplishments. But unlike those more modern-day media moguls, Dorothy Kilgallen used her platform to ask some dangerous questions, preferring to shine a light in dark places rather than repeat whatever talking points the mainstream handed to her. Dorothy knew she had something that her male counterparts didn't. Like Cassie Chadwick, who I covered last season, Dorothy knew she could use men's preconceived notions of women against them to get what she wanted. As her peer and contemporary, Louis Sobel, a fellow reporter at the Journal American, wrote of her, quote, "This slender, wide-eyed, deceivingly naive in attitude and soft-spoken mannerisms female reporter was to herself mingling with a new set of characters. Racket guys, grafters, phonies, creep Janes, society fops, chorus girls, pimps, overdressed Jezebels, and their rent payers." End quote. She counted the likes of Jane Mansfield, George Harrison, Joan Crawford, and Ernest Hemingway among her friends, frequently hosting them at the lavish parties she threw in her Midtown East brownstone in Manhattan. Hemingway once remarked that Dorothy was, quote, "the greatest woman writer in the world." Dorothy's syndicated column, The Voice of Broadway, which, despite its name, was an outlet for far-reaching topics including, of course, Broadway, but also politics and true crime, was published in 200 papers across the country, and, in a day of fewer media outlets, was wildly popular. But despite her popularity, or perhaps because of it, Dorothy made some enemies in the highest halls of power. She pissed off some pretty major players, from gangsters to presidents, and that may have cost her her life. But before we get to her end, let's go back to her beginning. Dorothy Kilgallen was born on July 3, 1913, to Jim and May Kilgallen. Jim was a successful reporter. He'd interviewed major celebrities from Thomas Edison to Al Capone. He covered the Rosenberg spy case in which an American couple were convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. Probably most importantly, Jim's reporting exposed the existence of the Dachau prison camp in Germany. By the time she was 8 years old, Dorothy decided she wanted to follow in her father's footsteps and become a reporter. To his credit, rather than steering her toward a more appropriate career path, say, becoming a secretary or simply waiting around to get married, Jim encouraged Dorothy's interests, urging her to write and submit letters to the editors of local papers. At 12 years old, Dorothy became a published writer when a letter she wrote to the Brooklyn Eagle was printed. Apparently, a reader had been critical of one of Dorothy's idols, silent screen legend Roman Navarro. So Dorothy penned a strongly worded defense using the pseudonym Dorothy Lorington. Dorothy was, rightfully, incredibly proud and made copies to pass to her friends. According to author Mark Shaw, quote, her father passed the newspaper around his office. The next day, she visited him and received a round of applause. She liked the attention. She liked being special, end quote. Dorothy began hanging around her dad's office, soaking up the news chatter. Her father's most important piece of advice to his budding protege, nothing was more important than the truth. By 1930, after a brief and unstimulating stint in college, Dorothy dropped out in order to pursue her dream of becoming a reporter. And in June of 1931, as a favor to her father, editor Amador Spiro of the New York Evening Journal agreed to give Dorothy a 2-week trial at the paper. Dorothy was passionate and enthusiastic and used her time at the paper to follow other reporters on assignment. She quickly became fascinated by the world of law. As her 2-week trial became a permanent position, Dorothy spent her days at the criminal courts where, as Shaw put it, she was, quote, captivated by the human drama of trials, where freedom and even life or death was on the line, end quote. But she was a woman, and still a teenager at that, and the men in charge at the paper wanted to relegate her to fluff while the men handled the real news. And so, in order to prove her worth, Dorothy took it upon herself to rewrite an article written by one of her male colleagues. She did so without lending her name to the piece, so that when it was taken seriously and praised by her editor at a meeting, she revealed she had been the one to improve upon the piece and was praised for her work. She knew that had she presented the rewrite as her own, it likely would not even have been considered. Front page news was trending more and more towards splashy murder cases, and much to Dorothy's delight, she was assigned her first murder trial sometime in 1933. After 4 rejections from her editor and 5 rewrites, her story was published. And then, in 1934, at just 21 years old, Dorothy had her first front-page story published, a piece covering the murder trial of one Anna Antonio, who'd paid drug dealers $800 to kill her husband in an attempt to cash in on his $5,300 life insurance policy. A year later, Dorothy was assigned to cover what the media had dubbed the trial of the century. German-born Bruno Hauptmann was charged with the kidnapping and killing of famed aviator Charles Lindbergh's son. Dorothy got a front-row seat at the trial right behind Hauptmann, where she tried her best to use her girlish charm to talk to Hauptmann despite the prosecutor's insistence that he not communicate with the press. Following her successful coverage of the Lindbergh trial, the Evening Journal awarded Dorothy with her very own column, The Hollywood Scene. Dorothy shrewdly parlayed her new role covering New York and Hollywood's glitterati by securing herself a spot in the widely publicized Race Around the World, a literal race around the world in which Dorothy and her two competitors, Bud Elkin and Leo Kieran, both New York newspaper reporters themselves, had to make it around the globe utilizing only methods of transportation available to the general public. In other words, no private jets. According to Shaw, quote, displaying her resourcefulness, Kilgallen managed to obtain 16 visas and a passport in 2 days. Her only baggage was a converted hatbox and battered typewriter, end quote. Dorothy came in second and was heralded for her achievement by the likes of First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and Amelia Earhart. She was, indeed, the first woman to fly across the Pacific Ocean. She was applauded for her, quote, willingness to carry the banner for women's rights by challenging the two men, end quote. Dorothy Kilgallen was now in the same spotlight as the stars she covered in her column. Indeed, she had enough of a foot in the door in Hollywood that she wrote a screenplay based on her adventures around the world, aptly called Girl Around the World, and presented it to producers at Warner Brothers. The producers said thank you very much and took her script, renamed it Fly Away Baby, cast Glenda Farrell as Dorothy, and gave Dorothy a based on an idea by credit. But hey, at least she got that credit. Apparently, the first Frankenstein movie credited Mary Shelley thusly, quote, from the novel by Mrs. Percy B. Shelley. Take it from me, Mrs. Kurt E. Bloom, that shit is fucked up. Nevertheless, Dorothy's name was now cemented as a bona fide reporter, such that she was invited to cover FDR Jr.'s wedding and King George VI's coronation. In 1938, Dorothy began her syndicated column, The Voice of Broadway, about which the following announcement was made. Quote, the first and only woman columnist, Dorothy Kilgallen's Voice of Broadway column starts Monday. A man's job. Beginning Monday in the New York Journal American, Dorothy Kilgallen will report daily on the deeds and misdeeds of Broadway. A man's job. But Dorothy has been doing a man's job and doing it better. End quote. Sigh. It's hard to overstate her popularity. To have a column premiere in 200 papers across the country is a big deal. A very big deal. Especially back then. Especially given her age and, well, you know, the fact that she owned a vagina. And while Dorothy's column was called The Voice of Broadway, she did not limit its content to Broadway's goings-on, but rather used it as a platform to report on domestic and foreign affairs. Strangers, did you know that taking care of your mental health is not just good for your health, it's also super hot? Try going on a date with an untherapized person. No, thank you. These days, unless you're actively working on improving your mental well-being, you're going to be swiped left on. If I were looking to date, my profile would say, must be in therapy. And now, therapy is more accessible and affordable than ever. That's thanks to Rula. Rula does things differently. They partner with over 100 insurance plans, making the average copay just $15 per session. It's real therapy from licensed professionals at a price that actually makes sense. Think about it. You use your insurance benefits to maintain your physical health, so why wouldn't you do the same for your mental health? And Rula isn't just affordable. The experience is tailored around you. Other online therapy platforms might match you with the first available provider, whether or not they're the right fit. Rula considers your goals, preferences, and background to provide you a curated list of licensed, in-network therapists who are actually aligned with what you need. Because they know that finding the right therapist can make all the difference. Thousands of people are already using Rula to get affordable, high-quality therapy that's actually covered by insurance. Visit rula.com/strange to get started. That's rula.com/strange. You deserve mental health care that works with you, not against your budget. By 1940, Dorothy Kilgallen was at the top of her game. She'd married Broadway star turned producer Richard Colmar at 27. The wedding was attended by 800 guests, including Ethel Merman, Walter Huston, Milton Berle, and Thomas Dewey, the 1944 Republican presidential candidate who lost to FDR. She, of course, kept her own name. The couple had three children together and hosted a Saturday morning radio show on New York's WOR called Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick, which ran for 18 years. The show frequently featured their children and consisted of pleasant breakfast table chit-chat. Dorothy made her TV debut in 1949 on an ABC show called Leave It to the Girls, which was basically The View of its day. Described by author Mark Shaw, quote, along with five career-minded women, Kilgallen bantered about female challenges in a man's world. They delved into such touchy subjects as love, relationships, and business, each connected to the battle of the sexes. Viewers were impressed with Dorothy's drive toward winning, her need to succeed in every aspect of her life. Some viewed her demeanor and the tone of her newspaper columns as bitchy, end quote. What? An opinionated woman was seen as bitchy? Well, never in all my years. I don't know what happened to Leave It to the Girls, but by 1950, Dorothy had joined the regular cast of What's My Line, a popular game show in which panelists would try to guess the profession of mystery guests. 1953 was a big year for Dorothy. As her star continued to climb, she covered the wedding of JFK and Jackie Bouvier, as well as Queen Elizabeth's coronation. I want to pause here for a moment to say that a stunning amount of the coverage on Dorothy that I read included detailed descriptions of her looks. Everyone was always pointing out her Irish skin, her large eyes, and her delicate features. One ex-boyfriend even found it necessary to comment on her ample breasts. This was, of course, apropos of absolutely nothing and had no bearing on her skills as a writer and reporter, and I dare say this kind of effusive description is almost never heaped upon men because their merit tends to stand on its own, regardless of the shape of their jaw or the number of pockmarks bedeviling their faces. In his biography of her, Mark Shaw spends an inordinate number of words on Dorothy's looks as well. For instance, this passage, quote, as September 1953 dawned, Kilgallen continued to keep abreast of the world events while soaking up New York City nightclub scene, noted the marriage of John Kennedy to Jacqueline Bouvier, and attended Queen Elizabeth's coronation. Wearing a tiara, Kilgallen looked stunning in a silver gown with 10,000 embroidered jewels and pearls encrusted at the scalloped neckline. A white mink cape lined with silver lamé completed an outfit truly fit for a queen. Kilgallen's coverage of the coronation earned her a Pulitzer Prize nomination, end quote. The woman was nominated for a Pulitzer, and Shaw tossed that in after blathering on about what she wore to the queen's coronation. Dude. Through all of this, she never had to give up her beat of covering high-profile murders. And in 1954, she not only covered the infamous case of Sam Shepard, the murderer, not the playwright, but she handed over the information that would lead to his convictions overturning. As you may recall from my two-part episode in season 4, Dr. Sam Shepard was accused of murdering his pregnant wife in their bed. After he was convicted for the murder, the Supreme Court overturned the conviction upon learning that Dorothy had blabbed to the judge in the original case, "It's an open and shut case, he's guilty as hell." Apparently, that's a big no-no. I'll rerun those episodes next week and the week after just for funsies. Oddly enough, despite Dorothy's declaration in the judge's chambers, apparently over the course of Dr. Shepard's first trial, she became less convinced of his guilt. As Mark Shaw put it, quote, Kilgallen's articles in the Journal American were incisive as she honed her skills as a true investigative reporter. Listening to the evidence during the 9-week trial, she had doubts about Shepard's guilt. When the jury voted for conviction, the newspaper headline read, Dorothy Kilgallen on Shepard trial, astounded by verdict, sees reversal possible, end quote. In this article, Dorothy wrote, quote, the prosecutors for the state of Ohio did not prove Shepard was guilty any more than they proved there were pinheaded men on Mars. I have covered a score and more of murder trials. This was the first time I have ever seen what I believe to be a miscarriage of justice in a murder case. It is the first time I have ever been scared by the jury system, and I mean scared, end quote. One wonders if perhaps she made up the story about influencing the judge in order to get the case overturned. Either way, Dorothy Kilgallen was making waves and ruffling feathers, not just for her reporting, but for her private life as well. The president was famously sleeping with half of Hollywood, but God forbid a woman in what was apparently a pretty loveless marriage let her hands and heart wander. Sometime before her third child was born in 1954, Dorothy had begun an affair with the famous singer Johnny Ray, who was 14 years younger than her. This was such a scandal, apparently, that fellow columnist Liz Smith wrote that the affair was peculiar, in part because, quote, here was this white-gloved Catholic making out with a homosexual all over town, end quote. Girl, are you okay? Around this time, Dorothy got a real bug up her ass about Frank Sinatra. I'm not going to try to find the inciting incident. I don't know who started the feud or why, but Dorothy started jabbing at Sinatra every chance she got in her column, The Voice of Broadway. She constantly made reference to how many women he had around him and referred to his apartment in New York City as his hideaway, implying, not incorrectly, that he was engaged in nefarious dealings. In February of 1956, her pokes became full-on punches when she went from publishing small quips about Frank to full columns in a series she called The Real Frank Sinatra, in which she detailed his bad behavior both on set and off, accusing him of everything from not showing up to rehearsals to being petulant and offensive to everyone around him. The first of her series on Sinatra began, quote, success hasn't changed Frank Sinatra. When he was unappreciated and obscure, he was hot-tempered, egotistical, extravagant, and moody. Now that he is rich and famous, with the world on a string and sapphires in his cufflinks, he is still hot-tempered, egotistical, extravagant, and moody, end quote. Dorothy was clear in these columns that she agreed with popular opinion of the day that Sinatra was exceptionally talented. In a column about him from March 2nd of 56, Dorothy bitterly complained, quote, who cares about his inexplicable bouts of despondency, his sudden rages, his offstage weaknesses for wine, women, and brawls, so long as he can sing I Concentrate on You better than anyone in the world? What does it matter to the anguished director of a TV spectacular like Our Town that he didn't show up at rehearsals if he turns out to be brilliant at airtime? End quote. She all but called him a slut in one instance, writing that with all the women who threw themselves at him, he was unable to duck. Oddly enough, in my opinion, her ire at Sinatra reads almost like someone whose crush was unrequited. Not only did she list off the famous women she believed he consorted with, but she went particularly hard after the ones who were not famous, writing, quote, many more, of course, have been fluffy little struggling dolls of show business, pretty and small-waisted and similar under the standard layer of peach-colored pancake makeup. They are starlets who never got past first base in Hollywood, assorted models and vocalists and chorus girls now lost in the ghosts of floor shows past. Others belong to the classification most gently described as tawdry, end quote. Yikes, girl. Methink the lady doth protest too much. You know what I mean? For his part, Sinatra jabbed back, calling her chinless, and said she looked like a chipmunk in his nightclub act. In turn, Dorothy upped the ante and began highlighting his mafia connections, which everyone knew about, but no one really talked about. Whether or not it was her coverage of Sinatra that turned her attention to the mafia or not, Dorothy's attention turned to the mafia and its connections in Havana at the time. In 1959, the U.S. government supported Fidel Castro, and in turn, Castro looked the other way while the mafia ran clubs and casinos in Havana. Listen, I'm no political scientist, and I won't pretend to understand the machinations of whatever was going on between the United States and Cuba at the time. But in July of 1959, Dorothy became the first reporter to allege that the CIA and organized crime in the States were colluding to assassinate Fidel Castro. She wrote, quote, "If our State Department heads in Washington deny they're gravely worried over the explosive situation in Cuba and nearby Latin American countries, they're either giving out false information for reasons of their own or playing ostrich, which might prove to be a dangerous game. U.S. intelligence is virtually non-existent if the government isn't aware that Russia already has bases in Cuba, and Russian pilots in uniform are strutting openly in Havana. Fidel Castro is the target for so many assassins, they're apt to fall over each other in their efforts to get him. The mafia want to knock him off. So do the Batista sympathizers, of course. And then there are his own disillusioned rebels, just for starters. He has machine guns and other ammunition mounted on every key rooftop near his base of operations. But the smart money doubts if any amount of precaution can change his status as a clay pigeon." End quote. Whatever her underlying reasons may have been, Dorothy began interviewing Cuban exiles in Miami about their hatred of Castro and his regime, putting the CIA and the State Department on blast, and in turn, the FBI put Dorothy Kilgallen on their watch list. I don't know if Dorothy knew she was on the government's watch list, but she was watching the government, and in particular, JFK and his personal life. Dorothy was close enough to the administration that she scored a tour of the White House for herself and her son, given by none other than her friend and JFK's press secretary, Pierre Salinger. But Dorothy did not let JFK's hospitality prevent her from breaking the news, or at least the rumor, that he was having an affair with Marilyn Monroe. On August 3, 1962, Dorothy wrote in the Voice of Broadway column, quote, "Marilyn Monroe's health must be improving. She's been attending select Hollywood parties and has become the talk of the town again. In California, they're circulating a photograph of her that certainly isn't as bare as the famous calendar, but is very interesting. And she's cooking in the sex appeal department, too. She's proved vastly alluring to a handsome gentleman who is a bigger name than Joe DiMaggio in his heyday. So, don't write off Marilyn as finished," end quote. In fairness, it's not like she came out and said JFK is shtupping Marilyn Monroe, but everyone knew who and what she was talking about. Incidentally, although probably not incidentally at all, Monroe was found dead of an apparent overdose 2 days after Dorothy's column implied she was having relations with the president. Dorothy herself didn't buy it. She wrote, quote, "Why was Marilyn's door locked that night when she didn't usually lock it? If she was just trying to get sleep and took the overdose of pills accidentally, why was the light on? Usually people sleep better in the dark. The real story hasn't been told, not by a long shot," end quote. One might imagine, given the timing and suspicious circumstances, that some people in power might have been unhappy with Dorothy poking her nose in the president's personal affairs, pun intended. But if they were unhappy about that coverage, they were about to get real steamed about where she focused her attention next. Strangers, it is 6,000 degrees right now, and I hate to say it, but be prepared for this to be the new normal in summer. If you're like me, you need to stay very cool at night or you will be waking up in soaked sheets, which is, believe me, gross. With Miracle Made sheets, no matter what's happening outside, I stay cool and dry all night. Did you know that all that sweat you produce creates bacteria growth? Bacteria can lead to gnarly smells, colds, and skin problems. But Miracle Made sheets prevent 99% of bacteria growth, which means they stay cleaner longer. It's all thanks to the silver-infused fabric with technology inspired by NASA. It also means less laundry. And don't worry, somehow these sheets are almost as soft as satin. They feel luxurious, but don't come with the high price tag of luxury sheets. Miracle Made sheets make the perfect housewarming gift, and trust me, your friends will thank you. Upgrade your sleep or give the gift of better rest. Go to trymiracle.com/strange to try Miracle Made sheets today. You'll save over 40%, and when you use promo code STRANGE, you'll get an extra 20% off, plus a free 3-piece towel set. They make an amazing gift, and with a 30-day money-back guarantee, there's no risk. That's trymiracle.com/strange. Code STRANGE at checkout. Thanks to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. Before I begin this section, let me be clear that I am not stating my own opinion. I know people have very strong feelings about who killed JFK, but please don't come yelling at me if you disagree with Dorothy's reporting. She's dead, spoiler alert, and I am neutral on the topic. On November 22, 1963, John F. Kennedy Jr. was quite famously and quite publicly assassinated during a motorcade tour through Dallas. Kilgallen, who was watching the event live on TV, was devastated as she considered JFK to be a friend. But she was also immediately suspicious. Of all the dust she'd kicked up over her years of reporting on Sinatra, the Mafia, the CIA, and Cuba, it may just be that the dust she would proceed to kick up surrounding the circumstances and actors in JFK's assassination might have been enough to literally bury her. Dorothy immediately began phoning contacts in Dallas as she watched the news coverage unfold. During a press conference, which aired live at midnight East Coast time, DA Henry Wade claimed Lee Harvey Oswald, whom they'd already captured and detained, was a member of the Anti-Castro Free Cuba Committee. Apparently, several people called out to correct Wade, who'd misnamed the name of the group. One of those voices belonged to Jack Ruby, owner of a strip club called the Carousel in Dallas, who called out, "Henry, that's fair play for Cuba Committee." The discrepancy being, it seems, that the group he was accusing Oswald of belonging to was actually pro-Castro. Again, I'm not a political scientist and I don't know the ins and outs of this, but it was significant enough to Dorothy that she made note of it. At 11:15 a.m. on November 24th, Dorothy, along with millions of others, watched the live televised perp walk of Oswald as he was escorted from one jail to another. She watched as Jack Ruby pulled a pistol, not more than 15 inches from Oswald, who was left exposed without an officer in front of him, and squeezed the trigger, killing Oswald. Mark Shaw, author of The Reporter Who Knew Too Much, described Dorothy's reaction this way. Quote, "She walked around her townhouse in disbelief. 2 assassinations in 3 days, she told herself. Something doesn't make sense. Something's very wrong." Certain the killing of Oswald confounded logic, Dorothy Kilgallen began to investigate the man she learned was Jack Ruby. She wondered why he was present in the Dallas Police Department basement for Oswald's transfer. Within minutes, she reached out to contacts in the department looking for answers. End quote. On November 29th, Dorothy noted with interest President Lyndon Johnson's formation of the Warren Commission, which was set to investigate the assassination. She immediately began running her own background checks on each member of the Warren Commission. As coverage of the assassination continued, Dorothy was the first and only reporter at the time to publicly doubt the Oswald alone narrative. According to a piece from the New York Post from 2016, quote, "Kilgallen, who called laughable the Warren Commission's conclusion that Oswald acted alone, launched her own probe. She compiled a thick file of evidence, interviews, and notes, always keeping it close or under lock and key," end quote. This infuriated J. Edgar Hoover, who already hated Kilgallen. Per documents obtained through a FOIA request by author Mark Shaw, the FBI continued to monitor Dorothy during this time. Dorothy wondered in her column why Oswald, whom she said would have been, quote, the most important prisoner the police in this country had in 100 years, was treated so casually. She wrote, quote, the case is closed, is it? Well, I'd like to know how, in a big, smart town like Dallas, a man like Jack Ruby, owner of a striptease honky-tonk, can stroll in and out of police headquarters as if it was a health club at a time when a small army of law enforcers is keeping a tight security guard on Oswald. Security, what a word for it. End quote. In his research for his biography of Dorothy, Shaw apparently analyzed the 2,000-page transcript of the Jack Ruby trial in an effort to understand why Dorothy rejected the Oswald alone theory. According to a piece in the New York Post, Shaw, quote, cites little-known testimony that as JFK was killed, Ruby sat in a Dallas Morning News advertising office with a direct view of the Texas School Book Depository, where Oswald fired the fatal shot. Others testified that Ruby got into press conferences that night and the next day, making like a reporter. A parking garage manager overheard Ruby on a payphone discussing Oswald's transfer to the county jail. Quote, he told whoever he was talking to that he would be there, the witness said. Ruby later maintained his shooting of Oswald was spontaneous, end quote. Another major detail Dorothy found suspicious was Ruby's choice in lawyer. For some confounding reason, Ruby hired Melvin Belli, an injury attorney with known mob ties who had never argued a criminal case. The story went that during the presidential motorcade in Dallas, Belli was lunching in San Francisco. For some reason, a waiter told Belli that Ruby had killed Oswald, and Belli's response was, "Well, since Oswald's dead, I'll have to defend Ruby." Huh? Belli's lunch companion was also like, "Huh?" and asked Belli to explain, which apparently he did not do. Dorothy was not the only one who thought Belli was the wrong choice to represent Ruby. On December 12, 1963, American Bar Association president-elect Edward Kuhn told reporters, quote, "Belli is not a criminal defense lawyer. He will make a circus out of this case," end quote. While others might have shrugged Ruby's choice of lawyer off as odd, for Dorothy, it was just further proof that something was really not right about the whole affair. As Jack Ruby's trial got underway, Dorothy made sure she was staying at the same hotel in Dallas as Belli and invited him to dinner, during which she asked him if she could interview Ruby. Belli declined the request on the grounds, he said, that Ruby was crazy. While Belli was busy insisting his client was too crazy to give an interview, he also managed to let Dorothy know that he himself was interested in, wait for it, becoming an actor. Dorothy, being brilliant and cunning, was like, "Well, you know, I am a television personality and could definitely make you some introductions if you let me interview Ruby." On February 23, 1964, the Journal American printed Dorothy's exclusive, titled "Nervous Ruby Feels Breaking Point Near." Quote, "Jack Ruby's eyes were as shiny, brown and white bright as the glass eyes of a doll. He tried to smile, but his smile was a failure. When we shook hands, his hand trembled in mine ever so slightly, like the heartbeat of a bird," end quote. In the interview, Ruby expressed some serious fear, stating he thought he might be nearing a breaking point. When Dorothy told him she thought he was holding up well, he replied, "I'm fooling you, Dorothy. I'm really scared." I would have been too, if I had been him. Listen, I harbor no love for Jack Ruby, but this poor guy, his lawyer, was an actual clown. Strangers, there are things in life that you don't want to be transparent, like your swimsuit or your search history. But when it comes to your wireless bill, transparency is everything. That's why Mint Mobile's wireless plans have no gimmicks and no gotchas, just high-speed data and reliable coverage on the T-Mobile 5G network. And right now, all plans are $15 per month, even unlimited, We love Mint Mobile. We use it for our kid, and it is great coverage. We can get in contact with him anytime, anywhere. Mint Mobile took what's wrong with wireless and made it right with premium wireless for $15 a month. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. You can even bring your current phone and your number. To get your new wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/strange. That's mintmobile.com/strange. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/strange. That's it. There's no catch. Upfront payment of $45 for 3 months, $90 for 6 months, or $180 for 12 months. Plan required. $15 per month equivalent. Taxes and fees extra. Initial plan term only. Greater than 50 GB may slow when network is busy. Includes up to 20 GB hotspot. Capable device required. Availability, speed, and coverage varies. See mintmobile.com. Belli's defense was to claim Ruby was insane. This struck everyone as an odd choice, most especially Ruby, who reminded his lawyer that he was not, in fact, insane. Ruby also wanted the chance to testify in his own defense. Belli convinced him not to because, he said, the prosecutors would try to trick him and, more importantly, to trust his decision to go with the insanity defense. Dorothy openly questioned Belli's approach in her coverage of the case and suspected, in print, that J. Edgar Hoover and his henchmen were covering something up. I guess the implication was that Belli was somehow in bed with Hoover, probably through his ties with the mafia, and was given a defense hand-picked by Hoover. After all, if Belli pleaded his client had acted in the heat of the moment, Ruby would only face the prospect of 5 years in prison. Whereas, if he argued that Ruby was insane, he was far more likely to lose the case entirely and send Ruby to his death. And of course, a dead person can't spill any secrets. I'm no shady injury attorney with mafia ties handling my first criminal defense case against the U.S. government, but I am fairly certain it would have been relatively easy to convince everyone that Ruby, so distraught over the assassination of his beloved president, acted in the heat of the moment and should be granted some mercy. Surely most people would have been able to empathize with the man who murdered the president's murderer in a fit of despair. At some point during the trial, in between sessions, Jim Lehrer, who was at the time working for the Dallas Times-Herald and would later become the co-anchor on PBS's NewsHour, interviewed Dorothy and asked if she held the city of Dallas at all responsible for the president's death, to which Dorothy replied, quote, "I don't see why Dallas should feel guilty for what one man, or even three or five in a conspiracy, have done," end quote. J. Edgar Hoover, already hopping mad over Dorothy's open defiance of his carefully crafted Oswald Alone narrative, was sent into a further blind rage by Dorothy's continued nose-thumbing. Mark Shaw, in his review of the files, wrote this, quote, "While Kilgallen met privately with a Dallas Police Department source, J. Edgar Hoover and Clyde Tolson discussed the Warren Commission investigation at FBI headquarters. Hoover also mentioned his displeasure with Kilgallen's irreverent columns, questioning the official account. The director explained that any FBI information about the Kennedy family was off limits to reporters and the commission. The director emphasized again that Oswald acted alone. Hoover said they must head the commission in that direction and only that direction," end quote. And in case it's unclear, the head of the FBI is not supposed to tell a supposedly dispassionate commission how they should do their jobs. Meanwhile, Belli was fumbling the ball all over the courtroom. More than once, he referred to his client, Jack Ruby, as Oswald. During the trial, he called his client the name of the man he'd murdered. 5 times. Even the judge was like, "this fucking guy," shaking his head in disgust at Belli's behavior in the courtroom. Years later, Belli's chauffeur, Milton Hunt, told Shaw that Belli had confessed to him, quote, "the Ruby case is fixed. I'm just going through the motions. It's simply being staged for the sake of publicity. There's an inside thing and no way to win. It's a whitewash," end quote. For some reason, Hunt did not take this confession directly to the judge when it happened, probably because he believed the fix actually was in and he'd be swimming with the fishes if he opened his mouth. Belli rested his case on March 12, 1964, having never, it occurred to Dorothy, asked the jury to spare his client's life. And so, on March 13th, the jury unanimously found Jack Ruby guilty of murder with malice and called for his death. I'm sure Hoover expected this to be the end of the story, but of course, Dorothy was not about to let it go. She was convinced there was a conspiracy and made no attempt to be quiet about it. On April 14th, about a month after the Ruby trial had ended, she wrote a piece for the Journal American titled, "Why Did Oswald Risk All by Shooting Cop?" in which she wrote, quote, "A mysterious and significant aspect of the events following the assassination of President Kennedy in Dallas has never been explored publicly, although it must have occurred to crack reporters covering the case, as well as authorities investigating the tragedies. The important question, why did Lee Harvey Oswald, presumably fleeing from the police after the assassination, approach patrolman J.D. Tippit's car in broad daylight with witnesses standing by and shoot the policeman three times, although he had not said a word to Oswald? Oswald had managed to slip away from the scene and was, up to that point, not a reckless one. A man who knows he is wanted by the authorities after a spectacular crime does not seek out a policeman, usually, unless he has decided to give himself up, and certainly Oswald was not doing that. By shooting Tippit instead of trying to make himself inconspicuous, Oswald put himself in double jeopardy. His act almost guaranteed his arrest. Why? A whodunit fan would infer that the policeman knew something about Oswald that was so dangerous, the policeman had to be silenced at any cost. Even Oswald's chance at escape and freedom." End quote. Dorothy, knowing she had already gained the dangerous ire of the most important people in the country, which she had to know put her in their crosshairs, was still nowhere near putting the matter to rest. In fact, she was just getting started. Strangers, have you ever heard a true paranormal story that stuck with you for years? Like you wish you could forget it, but you can't? That's exactly what you get on Monsters Among Us podcast. Every week, real people call in and share their true encounters with the unexplained. Ghosts, strange creatures, missing time, things that just don't make sense. And here's the twist. You hear these stories in the witnesses' own voices, so it feels a little too real. Like Julie, who drove past a fatal car accident, then realized she had a ghostly hitchhiker, the deceased victim. Or a caller who saw three strange entities in the woods moving in unison, then lost 8 whole hours without any explanation. Or Mac from Mississippi, who broke his back when he fell out of his tree stand, only to be nursed back to health by a maternal Sasquatch. Literally. Yeah. There are over 500 episodes already waiting for you, so if you're into the paranormal or even just a little curious, this is a deep rabbit hole. So go check out Monsters Among Us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. At some point after Jack Ruby's trial, someone approached Dorothy with the full 102-page transcript of Ruby's testimony before his trial at the Warren Commission, which was, of course, supposed to be confidential. Dorothy, who refused to name her source, decided that rather than just report on the contents of the transcript, she would just publish the transcript in its entirety for the whole world to read. On August 9, 1964, Jack Ruby's testimony was published in 3 parts along with Kilgallen's commentary. She introduced the bombshell this way, quote, "Jack Ruby, in a purported secret testimony given to the Warren Commission, said it was strictly his own idea to kill Lee Harvey Oswald, accused assassin of President Kennedy," end quote. And although Ruby testified that he acted alone and without instruction from any subversive organization or underworld persons, he also said, quote, "The world will never know the true facts of what occurred. My motives. The people who had, that had so much to gain and had such a material motive to put me in this position I'm in would never let the true facts come above board to the world." End quote. And this statement, of course, only served to solidify Dorothy's belief that there was a conspiracy afoot. Needless to say, the powers that were furious at Dorothy and demanded to know who had leaked the document. She, of course, continued to refuse to disclose her source. And while papers printed the FBI's probe into the leak, for her part, Dorothy, of course, continued to print her own opinion. In a piece for the Journal American, she wrote, quote, "From what I have read, I would be inclined to believe that the FBI might be more profitably employed in probing the facts of the case rather than how I got them, which does seem a waste of time to me. At any rate, the whole thing smells a bit fishy. It's a mite too simple that a chap kills the president of the United States, escapes from that bother, kills a policeman, eventually is apprehended in a movie theater under circumstances that defy every law of police procedure, and subsequently is murdered under extraordinary circumstances. It seemed to me, after reading the testimony three times, that the Chief Justice and the General Counsel were acutely aware of the talk both here and in Europe that President Kennedy was the victim of a conspiracy. They took pains to prove to themselves and the world that no conspiracy existed." End quote. And then, on August 21st, two FBI agents showed up at Dorothy's front door demanding answers in an hours-long interview for which Dorothy did not have a lawyer present to protect her rights. Quote, "Things said to a reporter in confidence should be kept in confidence." She told the agents she would rather die than reveal her source. Dorothy Kilgallen had become a serious thorn in the government's side, and considering she suspected that JFK's assassination went all the way to the very top, she had to have known her own life was now in danger. If they could silence the man who assassinated the president, indeed, if they could have silenced the president himself, surely her life meant nothing to those invested in keeping secrets. Next time on Strange and Unexplained, Dorothy Kilgallen tries to outrun her problems and ends up dead under extremely suspicious circumstances. Strange and Unexplained is a production of Three Goose Entertainment and Grab Bag Collab. Special thanks to the generous patronage of our very first supporter at our Grab Bag Collab executive producer level, Jessica Hill. This episode was written by me, Daisy Egan, with research by Joe Gordette, editorial help from Becca DiGregorio, and audio engineering by Jeff Devine. If you'd like to support the show, please consider becoming a member of Grab Bag Collab. We have built an incredible community of listeners who support a small, profit-sharing, woman and non-binary-owned business. At Grab Bag, we're committed to giving a platform to voices who might otherwise get overlooked by bigger networks. Plus, all our contributors get to keep ownership of their content. It's a whole new approach to podcasting. Come check it out at grabbagcollab.com. For just $4 a month or $40 a year, you can get Strange and Unexplained early and ad-free. And for just $8 or $80 a year, you'll get all the shows Grab Bag has to offer, including my other shows, Dear Daisy and Shut the F Up Nick Lachey, as well as Amber Hunt's Crimes of the Centuries, The Catalyst, Tales of the Resistance, What If They're Wrong, and all of our quarterly shows. You can even sign up to join our live recordings. We have book clubs, live hangs, watch parties, and more. If you're feeling extra generous, you can sign up at the $50 level for even more perks, including all our shows and extras, and have your name read in the credits of our shows. Head to grabbagcollab.com today to join. To suggest an episode for Strange and Unexplained, you can email me directly at contact@strangeandunexplainedpod.com or go to strangeandunexplainedpod.com and fill out the contact form. You can follow me on Instagram at SNUPod or Daisy Egan, and join the Facebook page to be a part of the conversation. Thanks so much for listening, and stay strange.